interested in growing a greener future? Do you enjoy healthy, nutritious food? Would you like to learn how to grow your own organic oasis in an easy and efficient way? I'm Jackie Marie Beyer, the humble host of the Organic Gardener podcast, where I talk with amazing guests who are all using sustainable, earth-friendly practices. I interview backyard gardeners, market farmers, and people who have green businesses related to food. I'd love it if you'd join us on the Progressive Radio Network.
That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse.
Today's guest on Nature Bats Last is Earth and Paleoclimate Scientist Professor Andrew Glickson from the Australian National University. As always, listeners can call toll-free. It's a call-in show, so they can call toll-free from the US on 8888-744-888. Overseas callers can dial 001-60-556-25199. Those numbers are also available on a post on my Facebook wall. I'm not sure if we actually have Andrew with us. Are you there, Andrew? Typical. I saw this coming. It looks like Andrew hasn't been able to get in through Skype at the moment. What I wanted to do is discuss a March 6th story that Andrew had published on Global Research titled The Arctic Climate Tipping Points, Methane and the Future of the Biosphere. I'll give you, while I'm waiting and hoping that Andrew will come on, I'll give you a small excerpt from the article that was published in Global Research. The accumulation of many hundreds of billions of tons of unoxidized methane-rich organic matter in Arctic permafrost and of methane hydrates in shallow Arctic lakes and seas since before the Arctic glaciation of 2.6 million years ago, as well as in tropical bogs, has created a reserve of carbon whose release into the atmosphere may have catastrophic effects on the biosphere. According to the Global Carbon Project, up to 1,400 gigatons or 1,400 billion tons of carbon are on the land and 1,600 billion tons in the ocean, much of which may be potentially released upon a significant rise in temperature, which would cause widespread melting and defrosting of the polar ice sheets. This would ensue from major warming feedbacks from further combustion of fossil fuels from recoverable resources, estimated at least 11,000 gigatons, 1,100 gigatons, 1,100 billion tons. Are you there, Andrew? Charming. Our guest has not been able to get through. One of the reasons why I wanted to have Andrew on the show today is he is one of the few scientists who is prepared to point the finger at the existential risk of methane and to speak about the dire situation that we now find ourselves in. One of the complaints that this show has is that is scientific reticence from scientists. A lot of these scientists will talk about how bad the situation is in private, but they won't go public and speak about how dire the situation is. I'd like on that note to quote William Rees, who used the comment, "The scientifically necessary is politically unfeasible. The politically feasible is scientifically irrelevant." This is a situation that we find ourselves in now, where the green parties around the world and the left movement generally, who are fighting the issue of climate change, are talking about bringing in carbon emissions restrictions by 2030 or by 2050. We are already in an emergency situation. The situation is incredibly dire today. We can't wait to do any of these things. And when we do them, all they're talking about doing is rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. It's a complete and utter dereliction of duty, in my opinion. Whilst I'm waiting for Andrew to come on, I'll just work my way through some of the different links that I was going to go through with him. And when he comes back on, we'll go back and recap. One of the concerns that Andrew has contemporaneous with the climate crisis is the re-rise of fascism. We'll see that. Anyone who's paying attention can see that and can see that we get closer and closer to having some kind of nuclear confrontation between the United States and Russia. If I do get Andrew on the show, I'll bring that matter back up, but I'll quote something from an article that he wrote called "The Orwellian Climate and Faustian Bargain." He quotes George Orwell at the beginning by saying, 2 + 2 = 5, if the party say so. Quote, "Should anyone record the history of the 20th and 21st centuries, they may report that while temperatures and sea levels were rising, the human sense of reality has been clouded by electronic systems, including television, the internet, and smartphones, by science fiction, virtual realities, public circuses, fake news, gratuitous hype and superlatives, overtaking common sense and the quest for protection of the earth and the survival of the species. As glaciers melt, sea levels rise at an accelerated rate and intense hurricanes and wildfires increase by a factor of 3 since early in the 20th century. Unthinkable consequences of runaway global warming and nuclear wars loom. A new Orwellian age of fake news, half-truths, cover-ups, and false flags is becoming the order of the day. When trillions of dollars are spent on weapons of mass destruction instead of protecting nature and humanity from global heating, the hapless inhabitants of planet Earth are left with the choice between a nuclear winter and a greenhouse summer. When politicians lay flowers on the graves of soldiers and at the same time are rearming for future wars or decline to endorse anti-nuclear treaties or pledge token action on climate change while promoting new coal mines, can anyone believe it when they talk about a future? Hoodwinked by the half-truths of a conscience-free mainstream media, the inhabitants of Suburbia International have become more interested in cricket ball tampering, Eurovision-type circuses, and royal weddings, allowing the powers that be to proceed with policies leading toward genocide and ecocide. It may or may not be understood, but it is hardly reported by the mainstream media that under a global temperature rise of 1.5 C which has already been reached over the continents. Sea level is committed to rise by more than 10 metres, flooding the coastal plains, deltas and low river valleys where the bulk of the world's population live and grows food, and where major industrial centres and cities are located. This would include large parts of Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, Vietnam, China, Philippines, Egypt, Italy, the Netherlands, Germany, United Kingdom, Southeast USA, and many other parts of the world, triggering large waves of inflation. Although the precise timetable is unclear, several meters of sea level rise during the 21st century is very possible. One of the other issues that I wanted to talk about, if and when Andrew manages to get through, is the lies and deceit around the temperature baseline that we're all talking about. Sam Karana from the Arctic News blog believes that we're at about 1.75C already, which is way past the 1.5C aspirational level at Paris. If we keep moving the goalposts on the baseline, we can achieve 2C. We could do it as long as we said that it was only from 1950 or 1970. This is the dishonesty that we're confronted with as we march towards the abyss. Already, humanity has killed 83% of mammals and half of all plants on the planet. And that's when we're at what Sam Karana believes is about 1.75C, or what the dominant culture is telling us is only a little bit over 1C. We're in an emergency now, not long way off in the future. And all of this tittering around and playing with the seating arrangements on the Titanic is a complete and utter waste of time and a diversion away from the most extreme and important things that we should be doing. Quoted in the Global Research article that Andrew wrote is the 50 gigaton methane burst that has been hypothesized by Natalia Shakova and Igor Semelitov from the University of Fairbanks in Alaska. This is a really contentious subject, not because there's any doubt about whether it's possible that it could happen, but it's contentious in scientific circles because of the implications of what a 50 gigaton or more burst of methane would be. I notice in Andrew's article where he actually makes the point that 50 gigatons has been hypothesized by Shakova and Semelitov, but it also could be a hell of a lot more. Currently, as we are having this discussion or watching what's happening unfold on the planet, there is a heat wave taking place in Siberia. A heat wave in Siberia is almost as dystopian a thought as droughts and heat waves in Ireland, where my ancestors come from. Currently in Ireland, they are having a drought and they are having a heat wave. If anyone has any understanding at all about the climate, or what used to be the climate in Ireland, mentioning heat waves and droughts are just completely nonsensical in terms of what the old climate that we would have known about in Ireland existed. It's a radical show of how quickly things are changing. As part of the discussion, I wanted to bring up the fact that recently it's been discovered that there are methane-producing microbial communities now being found in fracking wells. So not only is fracking bad every single way that you can think, but there's a new one that's just been discovered, that methane-producing microbial communities can form in those fracking wells producing methane. Here's another byproduct of the fracking industry that doesn't or hasn't until recently been discussed. I noticed in the recent eruptions that are taking place in Hawaii that there's been on videos on YouTube where they've been showing methane fires around the lava flows. So not only has the planet been destabilized to the point that we're having more anthropogenic linked volcanic and seismic activity, but that has the possibility of releasing methane, mantle methane. So here's another source of methane that's appearing out of the blue. I'm often challenged and confronted and attacked for talking about the most dire prognosis or the most dire circumstances that we could see as this unfolding disaster takes place. And people think I should downplay the story, which is what everybody is doing. Everyone except a few small number of us are downplaying the severity of the crisis. On that note, I'd like to quote a quote from Joanna Macy from an article called The Greatest Danger. Quote, "Because of social taboos, despair at the state of our world, and fear for our future are really acknowledged. The suppression of despair, like that of any deep recurring response, contributes to the numbing of the psyche. What I'm seeing in the climate change circles that I mix in is that no one wants to talk about the worst case scenario. I think one of the reasons why the big NGOs don't want to talk about it is they have massive budgets that are generated by all the people contributing money who are trying to find a solution and see those organizations as being a pathway to a solution. No organization can be a pathway to a solution if it denies the overall problem. I can't help but think that fundraising is the main reason why none of the big NGOs like 350.org or Greenpeace want to go and talk about the true severity of the crisis, because they're scared that the donations will stop coming into them. There's a new paper just been released by the University of Hamburg. It was released on the 19th of March, 2018. I'll include it in the show notes, as I will with the other articles that I've quoted. The article's heading is "Thawing Permafrost Produces More Methane Than Expected." In a 7-year laboratory study, Dr. Christian Knoblach from University of Hamburg Center for Earth System Research and Sustainability and an international team have shown for the first time that significantly more methane is produced by thawing permafrost than was previously thought. The findings published today in the journal Nature Climate Change make it possible to better predict how much greenhouse gas could be released by the thawing of the Arctic permafrost. Quote, "Methane is a potent greenhouse gas, which is roughly 30 times more harmful to the climate than carbon dioxide. Both gases are produced in thawing permafrost as dead animal and plant remains are decomposed. However, methane is only formed if no oxygen is available. Until now, it was assumed that large amounts of greenhouse gases are formed when the ground was dry and well aerated, when oxygen was available. Christian Knoblach and his colleagues have now demonstrated that water-saturated permafrost soils without oxygen can be twice as harmful to the climate as dry soils, which means the role of methane has been greatly underestimated. Knoblach has, for the first time, measured and quantified in the laboratory the long-term productions of methane and thawing permafrost. The team had to wait for 3 years before the approximately 40,000-year-old samples from the Siberian Arctic finally produced methane. The team observed the permafrost for a total of 7 years. It's an unprecedented long-term study. What they found is without oxygen, equal amounts of methane and CO2 are produced. But since methane is far more potent greenhouse gas, it is more significant. Because methane production couldn't be measured, it was assumed that in the absence of oxygen, only small amounts of it can be formed. It takes an extremely long time until stable methane-producing microorganisms develop in the thawing permafrost, explains Knoblauch. That's why it is difficult to demonstrate methane production until now. The team has used the data to improve the computer model that estimates how much greenhouse gas is produced in permafrost in the long term. As they compiled a first forecast, according to a soil scientist, the permafrost soils of Northern Europe, Northern Asia, and North America could produce up to 1 gigaton of methane and 37 gigatons of carbon dioxide. But there are uncertainties as to what depth will the soil actually thaw by different dates. When will it be wet or dry? One thing is certain is the new data enable more accurate predictions about the impacts of thawing permafrost on our climate. We have a process happening in New Zealand at the moment where we're being asked to make submissions on the country's carbon budget, which I believe there is no carbon budget. But one of the things that I'm sort of hanging back about making is I've made submissions before, and I actually believe that the submission process is purely and simply going through the motions of consultation with the public. If the studio has it ready, I'd like to get them to play an oral submission that I made to the Ministry of Environment in 2015. Studio, are you ready to play that? Looks like we're not ready near yet.
They found evidence from Shell and the IAEA that on both of their internal documents and communications that 4.7 degrees C is baked in the short term, and in the long term we're looking at 6 degrees C. 6 degrees C is unsurvivable for almost every species on this planet. We have the, and what I would like to see the New Zealand government do when they go to Paris in December is I would like them to bring up the issue that the IPCC keeps continually talks about 2C, which was an arbitrary target that was never achievable in the first place and is already way surpassed already. We're 0.85 now. There's a 10 to 20 year lag between when emissions go into the atmosphere and when the cause and effect from those emissions can be measured and seen. The catastrophic storms and weather events that we're seeing now are a result of emissions that went into the atmosphere prior to the 1980s. We haven't even seen the damage that's going to come from what we've been emitting since that time. If I could get our government to do one thing, that would be to show the kind of revolutionary leadership that we have shown over the years. Mm-hmm. We're the first nation to give women the vote in this world. I want them to step up and confront the IPCC and confront everyone with this issue. This is a planetary emergency. It cannot be dealt with on the normal basis of nation states where they all sit down and debate forever. The IPCC has been formed 26 years ago. They've been discussing this issue all this time, and we have achieved zero. We haven't reduced our emissions. We've achieved absolutely nothing. This is the kind of leadership I'd like to see from our nation. Thank you.
So I made that presentation to the Ministry of Environment and it immediately was thrown in the garbage can. It wasn't paid any attention to, and I don't believe any of the other submissions was given any gravitas whatsoever. I'll carry on. It looks like we're not going to get Andrew today, so I'm going to have to ad lib it. You'll have to put up with my voice. I'm sorry about that. I'll go on with the rest of his article, The Methane Time Bomb and the Future of the Biosphere. But the extraction and transfer from the Earth's crust to the atmosphere of every economically available molecule of carbon, including coal, oil, tar sand oil, shale oil, methane gas, coal seam gas, and other forms of hydrocarbon, constitutes the most significant shift in composition of the atmosphere since the PETM hypothermal event about 56 million years ago and the KT extinction of the dinosaurs some 62 million years ago. Methane, the most potent common greenhouse gas, billions of tons of which are stored in Arctic permafrost, lakes, shallow seas, and sediments, is emitted as the Arctic warms by an average of 3.8 degrees Celsius. The release threatens to melt the large polar ice caps, leading to tens of meters of sea level rise and disappearance of species, a rate two orders of magnitude faster than they would have without human interference. Compounding this effect is extensive drilling for coal seam gas, perforating the crust in several parts of the world, and releasing commercial and fugitive emissions of methane into the atmosphere. Having sent young generations to kill and die in wars, the power presiding over the greatest mass extinction of nature since 66 million years ago. The accumulation of many hundreds of billions of tons of unoxidized methane-rich organic matter in the Arctic permafrost and of methane hydrates in shallow Arctic lakes and seas before and since glaciation about 2.6 million years ago, as well as in tropical bogs, has created a reservoir of carbon whose release to the atmosphere may have catastrophic effects for the biosphere. According to the Global Carbon Project, there are 1,400 gigatons or 1,400 billion tons of carbon on land and 16,000 gigatons in the oceans, much of which may be potentially released upon a significant rise in temperatures. This would ensure the major feedback effects of further combustion of fossil fuels from recoverable resources. Many years ago, the subject of feedback loops in the climate system were being discussed regularly in the climate community. Since we've got to that point and crossed a multitude of those tipping points, the subject's been dropped. The reason it's being dropped is because we're into the existential phase of this crisis, and humans have an uncanny knack of ignoring existential risks. As part of the discussion I wanted to have with Andrew was to talk about how just one of these major climatic events could topple industrial civilization. There's a wonderful presentation, or there's a few, by Joseph Tainter and also by Chris Hedges, the American journalist, about the fragility of complex societies. We've never lived in a society as complex as the one we have today. Our whole lives operate around the internet. If the internet goes down, you can't buy anything at the shop, because their cash registers now are invariably, or in the developed world at least, are invariably linked to the internet. I think that we could have just one catastrophic event that would have the ability to topple industrial civilization and also the economic system around the world, which the whole economic system is based on debt. The American economy has been selling trillions and trillions of dollars of their government bonds on 30 and 50 year timeframes. How do you sell a 30 year bond if we don't have 30 years? Some people have said, and Deep Green Resistance, an organization that I had a lot of time for and still do over the years, have been talking about the only chance we have to protect the biosphere is to tear down industrial civilization. I was a firm believer and fan of that idea until I read and learned about global dimming. Global dimming is the concept of the pollution that we've emitted up into the atmosphere is actually cooling the planet by reducing the amount of solar radiation that gets through to the surface. When industrial civilization falls over, we're going to lose very quickly. We will lose all of that pollutants that are in the air. And there'll be an immediate spike of somewhere between 1 and 3 degrees Celsius, just solely from the loss of global dimming. There's a wonderful BBC documentary on that subject, which is, I have a post on my website, kevinhester.live, covering global dimming and the implications that it has for the biosphere when industrial civilization falls over. I think everyone is underestimating how quickly the unraveling of the biosphere could happen. And it is so intrinsically linked now to industrial civilization. Everywhere you look, you can see that there are catastrophic weather events taking place. Ireland, with its drought and its heat wave, the same with Siberia, this heat wave that's happening at the moment in Siberia, for those of us who follow this situation, is literally terrifying. The East Siberian Arctic Shelf, where so much of this methane is stored, is only 50 to 100 meters deep. So those methane clathrates on the bottom of the ocean floor are very, very susceptible to warming water above them, and because it's so shallow, it's very easy for the sun to warm that water. So those of us who are concerned about the methane crisis are very, very concerned about this situation, and we actually, some of us, believe that it's possible that this great unraveling could take place this year. I know people will find that extremely alarmist, but as a sailor, what I always do is I have to prepare for the worst possible storm that I see. And the worst possible storm is that we could have an ice-free Arctic this year or in the coming years. Maybe this year's maybe not as likely as in a few years, but with the heat wave that's taking place in the Arctic at the moment, we're seeing the loss of sea ice at an unprecedented speed, and we think that we could have that discharge of methane that Shakova and Semilitov have hypothesized about. We could have that this year, and if we did, that would be game over for this planet. I think a lot of people don't understand how important the loss of sea ice and sea ice is to the ecosystem, and how large the area is up in the Arctic. 24% of the land surface of the Northern Hemisphere is covered in permafrost, and that permafrost is in the process of melting right now. It's in permamelt because of what we've done. President Niinistö, the president of Finland, said recently in northern Russia, if we lose the Arctic, we lose the world. Well, the reality is we have lost the Arctic. We're just in the free fall stage of going off the cliff and when you make impact at the bottom. I think one of the reasons why people don't understand how big the Arctic is and how important it is because of Mercator's projection, which is the system that we use for transferring the shape of the globe, of an oval or a circle, a ball, if you like, onto flat projection on a map. So when you look at maps of your country, wherever it is on the globe, it is not shown in Mercator's projection as the real size or shape of that landmass. And I think that's a real salient point for people when we talk about how significant it is losing the albedo or the reflectivity of the Arctic because we've lost the ice. People don't understand how much more long wave or solar radiation is getting through to the planet. Studio, I think I'll get ready to wind this this show up because the guest doesn't seem to be arriving, and I think I'm going to be boring people. So when you're ready, just put the Nature Bats Last theme music on, and we'll call it a day out with the show, I think. Sorry about everyone wasting your time with just listening to me and not hearing the scientists that we were hoping to speak to. Proceed with the theme music when you're ready, and I'd like to thank Ephra Zen for his contribution of his music, and I'll try and get back to you again.